Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Glad to have you listening in. It was 5 years ago today, an earthquake struck Haiti, causing massive devastation. And coming up at the bottom of the hour, we'll review what's happened since then and talk healing Haiti. But first, to prepare for that discussion, you'll hear some great insights on global poverty and putting our faith into action with World Vision USA President Rich Stearns and his wife, Renee. They've written a powerful devotional book called He Walks Among Us, and we'll be challenged to see the world as Jesus sees the world. So here's my conversation with Rich and Renee Stearns about He Walks Among Us. Early on in the book, one of the chapters is called Loosely Held, where you sort of address that question. How could Rich walk away from his corporate career? And maybe just say a word about what God has been teaching you even since that time about how we should hold loosely the things of this world.
Well, you know, Neil, I'll jump in on this one. When I was offered the World Vision job, you have to understand I was the CEO of a large company. I was making a lot of money. I was driving a Jaguar XK8 as my company car. We lived in a 10-bedroom mansion on 5 acres. We were living the American dream. And for a couple of kids that had grown up poor, I came from a broken home, alcoholism, bankruptcy, foreclosure. Renee came from kind of a blue-collar military family, never had much. And for me to make it to CEO and have, you know, all of the prestige and all of the trappings and perks of a CEO, and then to get this call, sell everything you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me, metaphorically, is what I think Jesus was telling us. I have to say it wasn't easy to do. I'd gotten very comfortable in that lifestyle and in who other people knew me to be. And so it took a great deal of faith and a wife that was right with me to finally have the courage to resign from Lennox and to, you know, leave all that behind and give my Jaguar back and put our beautiful house on the market and come out to World Vision for obviously a lot less pay. And it really was the Lord saying to me exactly what, you know, what Renee wrote in that devotional, Loosely Held, is I had some things firmly in my grasp. I had the CEO job. I had the prestige. We had the dream house. We had the perfect American dream lifestyle. And what the Lord was saying is, if you would let those things go, I could put something in your hands far more precious than that. But you're going to have to trust me on this. And he was right, because the last 15 years have been the most remarkable of our lives. We have seen the world, traveled the world, flown 2 million miles together. We have had experiences a billionaire can't buy. And most of all, we've been able to be useful to God and to be able to serve his purposes instead of our own.
There's a phrase in a poem that I'm familiar with that says that God can't pour his riches into hands that are already full. And I think that's what we were experiencing. We had full hands. The essay that you talk about, Loosely Held, is about a little boy who has a, quote, soccer ball made of scraps of plastic bags and a little bit of twine, and he and his buddies are playing a soccer game with this ball that they've made. And we came to visit them and offered them a brand new soccer ball, an American soccer ball, shiny, bright, with a little swoosh on it. And they were reluctant to let go of what they had, even though what we had to offer would be far better, because in their minds, they couldn't imagine anything more significant than this ball that they had worked so hard to make. And sometimes we're like that, too. We hold on to what's really subpar, imitation, because we can't imagine the riches that God has in store for us.
In one of the early chapters in the book, you have called Through Filtered Eyes, and you talk about how your daughter would accuse you of mother blindness. You know, you see the best in all the smallest accomplishments of children or grandchildren. Talk a little bit about how we can see, maybe with filtered eyes as God sees the world around us.
Well, the essay that you mentioned, we were visiting a family of Dalits, members of the lowest caste in Indian society, and I had the opportunity of sitting with a number of women, and they were making little matchboxes, and they were showing me how, and we were having a good time laughing about how inept I was at this. But yet one of the mothers stopped and through the translator asked me, she says, "Why are you here? What is it that you see when you look at us?" And of course, to Rich and I, they looked like anybody else that we had met on the trip through India. You know, they were hardworking, they cared about their children, and yet in the culture that they lived in, they were untouchables. They were the lowest of the low. Their husbands could only work in certain jobs, they could only live in certain places, and certainly nobody came to visit them. So this woman was puzzled. Why are you here? What is it you see when you look at us? And it gave me the thought of what is it that God sees when he looks at us? And the truth is that when God looks at us, those of us who have a relationship with Jesus Christ, when he sees us, he doesn't see our warts and blemishes and bruises. He sees, through the blood of Jesus Christ, he sees his son, valuable beyond measure. You know, what are we worth? We're worth more than birds. We're worth more than sheep. We're worth more than the lilies of the field. 1 Corinthians tells us that we are bought with a price, and that price is the life of God's son, Jesus. And as remarkable as that is, a lot of the people that we meet don't yet know that.
And Rich, I'm sure that as you, I know Renee talks in that chapter about, you know, understanding, seeing through Father's eyes as well, that it's called world vision, but what we really need, we need God's vision, don't we, for the world?
Well, we really do. And one of the frustrations that we have at World Vision all the time is trying to get, in this case, American people, American Christians, to see the world the way God sees it. In my book, The Hole in Our Gospel, I raise the question of, you know, do we think God actually looks at the children of the world and has and doles out his compassion based on where they live, their zip code, or does he love all the children in the world, whether they're Ethiopian or Indian or Chinese or American? And how do we then love the world's children the way God would want us to love them? And you know, even in our work with the poor, you know, it is so easy for us as Americans to go to a place where there's poverty and to feel pity and to look at all of the things that these people lack. You know, they're lacking clean water. They're lacking enough food to eat. They're lacking medical services. But actually, I'd like to turn that on its head, because if you believe that these people and their community were created in the image of God, then what we know about them is they have all the same gifts and abilities and creativity and entrepreneurship that we would find in any community in our country. The only difference is they've had circumstances that have not allowed their full God-given potential to come out. But we know they're hardworking. We know they're survivors. They've survived in conditions that you and I couldn't live in for a week. So they're clever. They're survival-oriented. They're resourceful. And what World Vision tries to do is bring out those God-given gifts in the community so that they can flourish. And that's why I say we often have a lot we can learn from the poor, because they're incredibly resourceful people. And what we try to do is liberate that God-given creativity and ability that we find in every human being around the world. But in terms of how we look at the world, it's very important for Americans not to live in our little bubble, you know, and to realize that there are 2 billion people that live on less than $2 a day in the world. There are almost 1 billion that have no clean water to drink and have never taken a shower in their life. So we have to be aware of that. And as we are aware of it, just like in the story of the Good Samaritan, we are morally responsible for doing something to help our neighbors. And when Jesus asked that question, who is our neighbor, the answer was not the person next door. It was any person in need where we have the ability to make a difference and to give them a helping hand. And so that gives us 7 billion neighbors around the world that I think the Lord wants this nation of Christians, the wealthiest nation in the history of Christendom, to use our abundant resources, both financial and educational and spiritual, to reach out into the world with God's eyes, you know, seeing the world through His eyes.
Talking today with Rich and Renee Stearns. Rich is, of course, president of World Vision at U.S., and Rich and Renee have traveled millions of miles and collected some amazing stories, and they've put them together in a wonderful book called He Walks Among Us, Encounters with Christ in a Broken World. It's a devotional, life-changing book, and we're going to talk more in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Talking today with Rich and Renee Stearns. Rich Stearns is the president of World Vision U.S., and he and Renee have traveled millions of miles, and out of that, encounters, as the subtitle of their books is Encounters with Christ in the Broken World. He Walks Among Us is the title of the book. And Renee, I want to just ask you, because you quote Lynn Hybels suggesting that rather than being overwhelmed by the world's problems, we should ask, what's mine to do? I think there are many people probably, you know, they think, well, I don't really, you know, I'm struggling or whatever the situation, but I, you know, what can I really do? Talk a little bit about that response.
Lynn was very powerful in my own thinking about this. We had been in Palestine and seeing some of the challenges that the Palestinian Christians were facing in their communities. And I was ready to go home and say, you know, this is not mine to fix. You know, I don't have any expertise. I can't understand the situation. It's much too complex for me. And she challenged me. She says, that's the wrong thing to say. She says, you need to ask yourself the question, what's mine to do? And I think that's the question we all have to ask. You know, the circumstances in which people live around the world are, Rich often says that poverty is rocket science. It's not, there's no quick fixes. There are no Band-Aids that we can put on that will help, you know, a woman who is living in abject poverty somewhere in the world to all of a sudden live life in all its fullness. But the question is, what part can I play? What role? What's my responsibility? And while some people diminish its importance, I think first and foremost, we can pray. God has given us this amazing invitation to come to Him with the concerns of the world. And so to be able to pray for the people around the world as you pray for yourself and your family, you know, as you take a drink of clean water, pray for those people that Rich talked about earlier who never in their whole life will be able to drink a glass of water without, you know, life-threatening bacteria. Pray for those people for whom three meals a day is an unheard of luxury. Pray for the people around the world who God loves and has called us to care about. And in the same way as we're to pray, we're also to be involved in whatever way we can through ministries in our churches, through the support of missionaries. I often say one of the very best things we've done with our children is to buy a map. Find out where these remote places are around the world. When you talk about a family living in Mongolia, be able to put your finger on the map and figure out where that is. Or if it's Ethiopia or Mozambique, learn about where people live and the kind of circumstances they live in. Because when we know more about them, we're more inclined to look at ourselves as brothers and sisters. And then once we know about them, then we can figure out what it is God has called us to do. As I've said, a lot of people from around the world have come to our own communities, and that's a wonderful way to get to know about the customs and cultures of people living in faraway places. And then to be involved in the work of organizations like World Vision. Certainly people can sponsor a child, provide for their necessities and provide for their communities. And I should let Rich talk about that. But there are lots of really simple things that we can do. It's easy to be overwhelmed with the problems of the world, but we need to find that one thing that we can do and do it with real commitment.
Christianity Today had a study, and this, you know, one of the most effective things to do is to be a child sponsor. I know there are many listeners right now that have done just that and are wondering, is it really making a difference?
Well, yeah, let me jump in here. We think that in many ways child sponsorship is kind of a brilliant idea that our founder had about 60 years ago when it was first introduced by World Vision. And it was just a simple idea that said, I can't fix the world, but I can help one child. I can't deal with this global poverty, global issues that are so big and overwhelming, but I can help one child. And over the years, World Vision has refined that child sponsorship model to become more and more effective. And essentially the way it works today, and we have over 4 million sponsored children around the world, but the way it works for us is that child that you might sponsor, and by the way, it's just about a dollar a day. So most of us could squeeze a dollar a day into our budgets to sponsor a child. And when you see the incredible difference it can make in that child's life, it's one of the best investments you'll ever make. But imagine if our children only cost us a dollar a day to raise. But what we do is we go to work in that child's community, and we understand that children don't live by themselves. They are placed in families, and families are placed in communities. And if the community has no clean water to drink, then the children don't have clean water to drink. If the community does not have enough food to feed everyone, then the children don't have enough food to eat. So you can't deal with children one at a time. You have to really work within their community context. And so we'll stay there typically about 15 years in the community. We'll work on clean water and sanitation and hygiene. We'll work on community health issues like safe childbirth and malaria prevention and basic first aid and helping moms understand how diseases spread and helping them understand the importance of nutrition. We'll work with the farmers to help them with better farming methods and access to markets, maybe introduce new crops to the region that provide micronutrients that the children and the families are missing. We work on economic development and microloans so that we can help them create little businesses, raising chickens or pigs, or maybe opening up a little retail store where they sell, you know, we might call it a 7-Eleven or something, but they sell sundries and they sell just basic things that people need, cough syrup, diapers, things of that nature. We work on education to make sure all of the kids are in school. And so over 15 years, as we work in these communities, we create a rising tide that lifts all the children. So not just your sponsored child, but all of the other children in the community are benefiting from this work. And of course, as a Christian organization, the other thing we're doing is we're trying to be the light of Christ in the community. If it's a Christian community, we work very closely with the local churches, and we want to leave the church stronger when we leave than it was when we arrived. If it's a community that's non-Christian, we try to be a witness to Christ, and we work on community values, and we try to introduce people to, you know, what we would call positive Christian values that can help their community. But sponsorship is a wonderful way. For about a dollar a day, you can sponsor a boy or a girl and roughly 60 countries around the world where we offer it, and it's easy to do on the World Vision website, just worldvision.org. But one last thing, Neil, some of the things we do are so incredibly cheap. You might be thinking, boy, I can't imagine somebody that has no clean water. They don't have water to drink, they don't have water to wash with, and they're drinking water out of a mud hole somewhere, and they're hauling the water with buckets back to their home. The cost to bring clean water to a person for life is about $50. Now, that's about 14 cents a day for a year. So you think, well, how could I possibly help somebody that doesn't have clean water? Well, if you've got 14 cents a day for 1 year, we can bring clean water to a person for life. So some of these things are incredibly inexpensive to do. It just takes the knowledge and expertise to do them. And, of course, it takes the resources and money to do them as well, but they can be done.
Renee, I was just wondering, maybe our time is getting by, but Renee and Rich, maybe even both of you. I know that it's sort of like children, you can't pick a favorite, but if you think about maybe a favorite story in the book, He Walks Among Us, is there one that sort of comes to mind you just has so impacted you?
I think for me, that's the story of a little girl named Nagavini in Ethiopia. We met her and her grandmother at their home. She had been abducted on her way to school and had been stolen to be a bride for a man in the community who could not afford the bride price. He kidnapped her, he took her shoes so she couldn't run away, and he chained her in a little hovel far from her home. And the grandmother was obviously quite distraught about this, and she went to the police asking them to help, and their response was, you know, this is just the way things are in our community. You're better off to leave well enough alone. But she, as grandmothers are wont to be, was very concerned about her granddaughter and insisted that somebody help. And so she went to the man, the World Vision employee in the community, and asked if he would help. Now, of course, his job wasn't to rescue kidnapped children. His job was to help provide the kinds of resources that Rich has been talking about that World Vision does when it works in a community. But this young man, Asatu, went to the police and tried to persuade them to help this grandmother and the kidnapped daughter, a granddaughter. And again, the police pushed back and said, no, we really can't. But he was very persistent, and he continued to appeal on her behalf. And finally, the police just sort of said, all right, we give up, we'll go and find her. And they did find her and brought her back to her grandmother. And the thing that makes the story stand out for me is what the grandmother said. I said, well, what did this young man's name, Asatu? I said, what did Asatu's work mean to you? And she said, you know, it would have been enough if he had just come alongside of me to be my friend, but he did so much more. And I have to say, in that instant, my mind went back to another desert community and to another child, but this one is laying in a manger. And I thought, you know, people will say it would be enough if Jesus would come alongside and just be our friend and be a good teacher and a good moral example, but that wouldn't be enough at all. Because more than a teacher, more than a friend, more than a companion to live our life with, what we really needed was a Savior. And I thought this young man, Asatu, in what he did in this community in Ethiopia, was being the hands and feet of Jesus to these people. And I thought that's what God calls us to do wherever we are, whether we're in Ethiopia or other remote parts of the world or even in our own communities. There may be someone who will never darken the door of a church, who will never open the scriptures, but for them, we can be the hands and feet of Jesus. We can be the fragrance, the sweet fragrance that he offers. We can be Christ's ambassadors as if he were making his appeal through us. And so just that image of this young man in Ethiopia who helped to rescue this little girl stands out probably more than any other story that I've encountered in my travels.
Rich, our time is gone. I want to just, and Renee, I want to thank you again for sharing these wonderful stories. And we should acknowledge your photographer as well, who really did a wonderful job. And, of course, you've got the God's Love for You Bible storybook as well for the whole family. And pray that it would be a resource that would have impact, a lasting impact for years to come. We thank you guys for the leadership you're providing for the challenge for us today.
Well, thank you, Neil. It was great to be on your program. And just one last word about the devotional, He Walks Among Us. These are not all gloomy, sad devotionals. They're many of them are uplifting and really hopeful. And I think your listeners would find it to be an uplifting journey of faith to walk through that book and meet some of the people that we've met.
Find out more about the wonderful work of World Vision on the website worldvision.org. Rich Stearns, president of World Vision U.S., and Rich and Renee joining us today. The book is called He Walks Among Us. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We've got a copy of Rich and Renee's devotional book to give away, so you can call now to be in the drawing. We'll do it at the end of the show. It's 877-933-2484. Coming up next, we'll focus on the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere and the devastating earthquake that rocked Haiti 5 years ago today. Stay tuned for my visit with Jeff Gatesick, co-founder of Healing Haiti. It's just ahead on Connecting Faith. We want to just find out a little bit about the ministry of Healing Haiti, but say a word about, let's just start with, because it was 5 years ago today, massive devastation, that earthquake causing thousands of death and destruction. And I'm just curious, I know you've made dozens and dozens and dozens of trips to Haiti over the years. What's Haiti look like now compared to, you know, 5 years ago?
Well, it's finally getting back to the place that it was pre-earthquake. All the tent cities that had popped up, literally hundreds of thousands of people living in tents are now all gone. Most of the damage to the roads have been repaired. Most of the buildings that have collapsed have been cleaned up and scraped and hauled away. Hasn't been much reconstruction as far as buildings are concerned, but the Haitian people are very resilient, and they got back to their lives and trying to provide for themselves. The interesting thing after the earthquake is the fact that the Haitian people weren't waiting for help, because they very seldom have ever experienced what help looks like. And the very next day we're out trying to feed their families and care for themselves.
You have had the privilege of being part of the help for Haiti, and I know you and your wife who passed away back 4 years ago, I think now, right?
2010.
Yeah, 2010. Mm-hmm. You know, God kind of broke your heart for Haiti. Tell us a little bit about it. In fact, I know Rich and Renee Stearns were saying, you know, one of the questions they need to ask is, what's mines to do? Your wife sort of had a similar question after, kind of going to Haiti. And talk about that, maybe just to introduce your passion for healing Haiti.
Well, I chased success for 25 years, and I found out that it was never going to be enough, that I always needed more of it, and I would never fill that God-sized hole in my heart. And my wife and I had supported ministry in Haiti for over 20 years, but never had taken the time. We said writing the check got rid of the guilt, but it didn't move our hearts. And it wasn't until we actually stepped out in faith and went, did God reveal to us what his plan and purpose for our life was. And he broke our hearts wide open. We couldn't believe the extremity of the poverty that we saw, and just the contrast between those who have so much and those who have so little. And when we got back on the plane after our first mission trip in January 2006, we just said to each other, we cannot not do something about this. And, chasing success brings temporary happiness. Seeking significance brings eternal joy. And I think that's what we found through serving in Haiti.
God got a hold of your heart. We're just talking, you know, before the broadcast that, I mean, it's pretty amazing. It's 90 minutes away, right, from the States.
Yeah, the poorest country in the world. According to the World Bank's in 2012, only 90 minutes away by plane from the richest country in the world. And it makes me think of the story of the Good Samaritan, how the righteous and high priests and Pharisees would walk this path. They'd go to church. They were all doing the right things. But they'd walk right by this guy in the ditch every day and not stop to help. And I think Jesus taught in parables because he wanted us to learn, and he knew that they'd be. Parables have no time limit on them. And it applies today. You know, we as a country oftentimes get up and just walk right by the poor, and to whom much is given, much is required. And I think you realize that even more when you've seen it firsthand.
You, on your website, healinghaiti.org, by the way, healinghaiti.org, you quote Micah 6:8 from The Message, Eugene Peterson's paraphrase. God has made it plain how to live, what to do, what he's looking for in men and women. It's quite simple. Do what is fair and just to your neighbor. Be compassionate and loyal in your love. And don't take yourself too seriously. Take God seriously. Talk about how that sort of happened for you in Haiti, and what Micah 6:8 looks like in Haiti from your perspective.
Well, when we first went to Haiti and we just saw firsthand the struggles of those living in the slums of Cité Soleil and Titanye, our hearts were just filled with just sorrow and angst, wanting to do something. For the first time in my life, I realized how blessed I was. I'd grown up in the richest country in the world. I never knew I was rich, but if you drive one car If you own one car, you're living in the top 2% of the world's wealth. So when it says in the Bible that it'll be harder for a rich man to get into heaven than a camel through the eye of a needle, I never thought that was me. I was just living a normal life. And I realized through this trip that I was living a very blessed life. And, you know, we really started by just trying to provide the basic needs of people, water, food, education. But I think over the last 9 years, we've realized that that's not enough to bring hope and dignity to people that have so little hope. You can only do that by teaching them how to fish. And so our ministry over the last few years has and will continue to develop into a job creation ministry where we come alongside those that God puts in our path and try to walk alongside them and through jobs and through a mentoring help lift them out of the poverty.
By the way, if you've maybe been on a trip with Jeff and their team to Haiti, or you have been there in some ministry opportunity, or maybe you are from Haiti and you'd like to just join the conversation, you're welcome to give us a call at 877-933-2484. It's 877-933-2484. Jeff Gasek, co-founder of Healing Haiti, in studio today. You talk about providing the basics, but that there's a need for hope. In fact, I know one of the areas you work in, it's basically hope is the sort of the last thing that's even there, right?
Yeah, the first place that we planted our roots was a place called Titanye. And Titanye is on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince, and it's one of the poorest rural villages. And when we went into Titanye, we met with the village elders and asked them how we could come alongside them. And at the end of the meeting, we asked them, what does Titanye mean? And they said it means less than nothing. And we, again, looked at each other and said, how can there be a place on earth that means less than nothing that people would want to live at? And Titanye is where the Duvaliers, Baby Doc, and Papa Doc would take their adversaries out into the foothills and execute them. And it's estimated that over 30,000 people were executed in the foothills. It's also the place where the Haitian government in 2010 or 11 decided to bury the people that were killed in the earthquake. And so the mass graves are located in the foothills of Titanye. It's just it's an area that has low self-esteem, very little hope, very few jobs. And so our next initiative in Titanye is to build a bakery that will be the first factory built in Titanye and will provide 50 jobs for that community.
You spent much of your life as a businessman running a successful business. I'm wondering, you know what it takes to run a business. How can business work in Haiti, and is that one of the keys to really seeing that country have the opportunity to grow and prosper?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, we believe that you have to meet the physical needs of a person before you can meet any other needs. But we try to incorporate meeting the physical needs, meeting the spiritual needs, and then providing hope through just coming down alongside people. We bring about 1,000 people a year down to Haiti on our short-term mission trips, but we've never built anything. We've never painted any schools. We've never constructed any buildings or churches with Americans. Our Americans come down to come alongside the Haitian brothers and sisters that we're serving down there. And in doing so, it changes the lens that the American missionaries see life through and gives them perspective on how blessed they are. And they have the opportunity to come back to the richest country in the world and be an advocate for those living in poverty.
You give the Haitians an opportunity to do their own work, right?
Yeah, everything we've built a church. We built a medical dental clinic, orphanages, feeding center, schools, and they've all been 100% built by Haitians. We've never had an American come down and do what Haitians can do for themselves. It's just one of our values that we have as an organization.
Is that a really kind of a key values? You've been there for years now, just seeing how maybe other agencies and NGOs and things work. That is that really a key element that is going to make a difference in terms of aid that might be going in?
Well, you know, I look at it and I say, you know, we, because of our that particular value, we employ over 100 Haitians down there. And so that's 100 jobs that wouldn't be there if we were bringing Americans down to do them. And so that in itself is a job creator.
Talking to Jeff Gasek today. Jeff's co-founder of Healing Haiti. Today, the anniversary of that earthquake back 5 years ago today now. Was a devastating earthquake in this country that's already been devastated by poverty, just 90 minutes away from our shores. We're going to talk more with Jeff in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you've been on a mission trip to Haiti. We'll talk actually a little bit about short-term mission trips to Haiti. Jeff's taken a number of them. He's on the way here shortly for another one as well, and we'll get his perspective on that. You can join the conversation at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484.
James 5:16 teaches that the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man or woman accomplishes great and powerful things. Since that's true, we would like to invite you to join the Faith Radio prayer team. If you sign up beginning in January, you'll receive a weekly prayer focus on behalf of individuals, marriages, families, pastors, and our communities as together we can make a difference for Christ. MyFaithRadio.com and click Pray to join the Faith Radio prayer team. Together, we can change the world through prayer.
That basketball game was so much fun.
When I saw my student's eyes light up, his college dreams came into focus.
That was truly exciting.
Saturday, January 24th. Join us for Northwestern's Hoops Hysteria. Immerse your student in campus life by taking a tour, visiting with professors, exploring your student's future, and cheering on the Eagles in a unique atmosphere of faith and sportsmanship.
And, oh yeah, there's a chance to win scholarships or textbooks.
Visit unwsp.edu/hoops. University of Northwestern, St. Paul.
Six past the hour, and talking today about Haiti, letting that earthquake just remind us of the needs in our hemisphere, as well as around the globe, the poorest of the poor. Jeff Gasek is a co-founder of Healing Haiti. It's founded by his wife, Alan, who died now in 2010 after a couple-year battle with cancer. Alan, having gone to Haiti, wrote in her journal this question, which is worth all of us reflecting on. What's God trying to teach me? And Jeff, maybe you had to kind of wrestle with that question a time or two as well, didn't you?
Yeah, that question really came up in March of 2010. While we were in Haiti, Alan received word from her doctor that the cancer had returned and that it was terminal. And she journaled what these questions of what God is trying to teach me. And I was so moved by just her questioning and knowing that she was going to die and knowing that God still had purpose for her life left and that she could use everything that God has given her to still bring glory and point it back to Him, that I videotaped her just talking about her journaling. And that's available on our website to see. But it's one of those things that God has created all of us for a purpose. And this world tells us it's all about us and that we can be anything we want and that we can have it all. But it's not true. God's created us for a specific purpose and wired us according to that purpose. And all we have to do to find it is go from seeking our purpose to seeking God's purpose for our life. And when we make that subtle shift, but significant shift, that's when he goes, okay, now they're ready to hear. And it says in Ephesians 1:11 that in him we were chosen. Can you imagine that the Almighty God of the universe chose each and every one of us? And that he predestined, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything for the conformity purpose of his will. You know, so that he not only chose us, but he's predestined works for us to do. And unless we seek his will and find, allow him to reveal his will to us, we'll never know. And I think that's been an amazing part of this whole journey.
Is taking a missions trip to a place like Haiti a good way for us to maybe just open ourselves up to what God may want to have for us?
Well, it sure worked for me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't take my first mission trip until I was 50 years old. And now we take over 1,000 people a year to Haiti, and many of them are 20-year-olds and teens and 30-year-olds. And I only wish that I would have done it so much sooner. You know, when I look at these young people that are going, I go, boy, God's got big plans for them.
So let's talk about short-term missions trips. What, in your mind, you take 1,000 people or so a year. What's helpful and effective? So what do you recommend? I mean, there's lots of people that are going, you know, not always done well.
Right? Well, you know, what we tell people is it's not about us. It's not about what we can do. It's about God and what he can do both in us and through us. And what we ask people to do when they're on that gangplank getting onto the jet to go to Haiti is to leave themselves here, to just go as an empty vessel, to just empty themselves of all their desires and what they think can do and what they think the trip's going to look like, and just give God the runway, let him speak into them. And by taking a short-term mission trip and just kind of closing the door for 1 week, on Facebook and on your cell phone and on your family, your friends, your job, and to just go down and with great expectations of what God will do, I think he really does have the ability then to speak into us through the people that he puts in our path and to come away seeing life through a different lens. You know, Haiti being the poorest country in the world gives us great perspective on not only how blessed we are, but also just how beautiful the Haitian people are. Very, very blessed to be able to go there as much as I do.
Are there some lessons that you have learned that you maybe couldn't have learned any other way, or just some things that you keep coming back to as you think about your many trips there?
You know, I guess a lesson I've learned is we think we have it all here, and we have so little. And the Haitian people who seem to have so little just have so much. I've seen faith down there like I've never seen. I've seen people give praise to God with so very little. And it just... I admire them for both their strong faith, their courage to step out in faith with nothing and still give God the glory for their lives. It's a people that, you know, I think everything you think about Haiti, God can turn that upside down and put it in a perspective of how he wants you to see Haiti.
Well, you've talked about you know, how the lessons you've learned and a bit about how your faith has been impacted. How do you have as a ministry organization now? Is there a way that you measure sort of progress and success? I mean, what does that look like for you?
Well, you know, when we first started going to Haiti, we thought Haiti was our mission field, and what God has revealed over the last 9 years that. We have a mission field here also. We have this duality of those we serve in Haiti and those we bring to serve. And what God does in the lives of both of these mission fields And, you know, we really feel like we're not responsible for the outcome of those, that that's kind of God's job. We just do what we can, and God does the rest. We're just a vessel, and we try to point the glory back to Him. But we, you know, we look at education. We're educating over 1,500 kids in our schools. You know, so that's progress. If in a country of 50% of the people not being able to read or write, by educating those 1,500 children each year, we're making a difference in their lives. You know, and that's measurable. We make a difference, you know, and again, it comes back to it's not about us. We're not actually making the difference. God is making the difference. And He's using ordinary people like me and others that volunteer for our organization.
Mentioned education. Now you do a water truck. Right? Mm-hmm. You've been doing that for years in one of the poor slum areas, right?
Yeah, we've been running a water truck for 9 years in the slum of City Soleil, delivering 3.5 million gallons of clean water, bucket by bucket, 6 days a week. And, you know, that's one of those opportunities we have to walk with the least of these. Haiti's the poorest country in the world. City Soleil is the poorest slum in Haiti. And the areas that we serve, Soleil 17, 19, Namboulé, Katsaki, are the poorest areas of City Soleil. And so we go in as deep as you can go at some of the worst poverty on the planet.
I know you have an event coming up here for Valentine's. By the way, speaking of Valentine's, I know that God has blessed you with a new love in your life.
So, yes, He has.
That's congratulations.
Thank you.
Wedding was just less than a year? Was it a year ago?
January 3rd, a year ago.
Okay, congratulations. Yeah. But just say a little bit about, people want to find out a little bit more about Healing Haiti. You do have some opportunities to do some things to focus on that needy country.
Yeah, well, we've got this event coming up. It's a Valentine event called the Sweetheart Ball. And it is, you know, what we're trying to do is take an ordinary holiday like Valentine's and just make it extraordinary. Many people go out and they'll spend $50 or $100 or $200 on Valentine's dinners and gifts. And rather than do that, the possibility of just coming to the Sweetheart Ball and to redirect that money to have purpose and significance is what we're trying to do.
Find out more about it and all the ministry outreach of Healing Haiti on their website, healinghaiti.org, healinghaiti.org. Is there one thing that you would just encourage us, want to leave us with in terms of maybe how we think or pray differently about Haiti, just using this, maybe this anniversary, earthquake anniversary as a reminder? What would you say?
Well, I would just advocate for people to seek God's purpose for their lives and to take time out of their busy schedule to serve, whether it's Haiti or any other serving opportunity. We are just so incredibly blessed, and we can learn so much from those we serve about our lives and their lives. And it's really about relationship and about giving God the runway and giving Him access to our hearts.
You've had quite a change coming to at age 50 to kind of move from the pursuit of success to pursuit of significance. That's been
I found that chasing success brought temporary happiness, and you could never get enough. And seeking significance brings the eternal joy that God promises through His Word.
And blessings to Jeff and your team as you continue to minister in Haiti. And well, it's 47 past the hour. Talking with Joel Rosenberg today, best-selling author, written 9 novels, the latest, The Third Target. But you could check any of the others. In fact, there's a great series, the 12th Imam, the Tehran Initiative, the Damascus Countdown. That was a great series talking about what's going on in Iran, and you'll find that pretty captivating as well. He's also written some nonfiction works. Books have sold over 3 million copies. Joel also has founder of the Joshua Fund, a nonprofit educational and charitable organization to mobilize Christians to bless Israel and her neighbors in the name of Jesus. And I want to ask Joel a little bit about the reaction to, as he writes his novels, and share is always some aspect of faith and prophecy as well. But, Joel, I'm curious to know, before we go on to that, you know, the Islamic State hasn't really delivered on its promises. You know, this is the new way to run a state. And I just read a report, I think it's out of the Washington Post about a week ago, saying, you know, there's a lot of criticism about that. Is there enough maybe public opinion criticism of those that are actually suffering under the hands of ISIS that that might provide some change internally?
Well, it's hard for an individual, you know, Arab Muslim or certainly an Arab Christian living in Syria or Iraq to do anything to stop ISIS, you know, because they are the Nazis of our modern time. I mean, they are just cruel and demonic. I mean, they're just killing and slaughtering people, and again, you know, using little girls as sexual slaves. It's so horrific, and they're really engaging in genocide or the early stages of genocide. So, you know, if you're an individual person or family, there's really nothing you can do politically. But in God's sovereignty, ISIS is so evil that many Muslims are beginning to ask themselves, if ISIS is what Islam should be, in other words, the sort of jihadist version of the Quran, I don't want to be associated with that. I don't want to be a Muslim anymore. That many, many Muslims are saying that, and they're either becoming agnostics, I mean, they're leaving Islam, but they're not telling anyone what they believe yet because they're not sure, or many are coming to faith in Jesus Christ as the only Savior and Lord. And I have traveled throughout the region and have many wonderful dear pastors and Christian leader contacts who are telling me they're seeing people come to Christ. They're seeing refugees who are fleeing from ISIS coming to faith. They're seeing them wanting to talk about Jesus, and they're seeing dreams and visions. They're reading the Bible. So I'm encouraged that what man is planning for evil, Jesus Christ is turning for good, and he's bringing people into his kingdom, even amidst this horrible, horrific, a genocidal environment.
You know, in your books, you often have someone who has a solid faith and is willing to share that in a winsome, relevant way. Talk a little bit about maybe the reaction that you hear from people as they read the books and say, well, I was going along with you fine, and then, you know, this came in, or what do you hear?
Right. Well, you know, if you read through some of the Amazon reviews of my past books, my boys and I like to sit around sometimes and just read through the ones that really hate me, because you know? Sometimes they're kind of comical and because they're so hyperbolic. But overall, we get a lot of emails and Twitter notes and Facebook messages saying they're really appreciative that I weave a message of hope, biblical hope, eternal hope, into these novels. You know, I try to make the book as, you know, heart pounding and adrenaline pumping as possible. So, you know, it's truly entertaining and informative, but I want it to be redeeming also. And not everybody wants that or appreciates that, but a lot do. And I got to tell you, I've met people, and I've had people write to me, who've come to faith in Jesus Christ, who have their lives changed because they were reading these, and they thought, you know what, I never really took that seriously. And then they began to read the Bible, and then they began to give their lives to the Lord, and that's encouraging. But even more as encouraging, I love when I get notes from Christians who say, I gave a copy of your novel to an unsafe friend or a relative or a colleague at work or school, because I wasn't quite sure how to share the gospel with them. But this novel, I thought, would do it. And And now I'm having a conversation with them. We go in and get coffee, and we talk about the book. And that's an easy way to get into spiritual themes. And that's encouraging to me, not just when I can share my faith in Christ through the novels, but when other people are sharing their faith, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, rather than giving someone a tract, give them a 400-page novel. But people do that. Thousands of people are doing it, and I find that fascinating and wonderful.
Well, I think probably, you know, if we're only getting our news from the, you know, from the Times or the Post or whatever, it's just, it's sort of refreshing to read a novel and know that, yeah, there is a bigger spiritual, there's more actors on this stage than what we're just reading about in the newspaper, so, which is great.
Yes, I think that's critical, and I think a lot of people know that the Middle East is important, and they know they should know more about it than they do, but they get a little hesitant. They know that they don't know the history or the context, but they don't really want to pick up a 900-page book of Islamic theology or Middle Eastern history. This is a high-speed, high-octane, exciting way to get into a story and learn a lot and begin to get some context for what's happening in the news, but to do it in a very entertaining, you know, and compelling way, I hope. That's my objective, at least. And the fact that they've, you know, they've connected, they've become bestsellers is amazing to me. You know, when you write your first novel, you just hope that your mother can find it at a bookstore within 100 miles of her house.
Sure.
You know, that's your main objective.
Sure.
And the fact that it's touched more people, I'm touched, yeah, and humbled by.
When we say that Joel Rosenberg is a million seller, it doesn't mean he's got a million in a cellar. No, they've all actually, they're in circulation. So Joel, a word about how would you recommend that we pray for these uncertain times in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf and, you know, Syria and Iraq? I mean, the Christians there that are suffering so mightily. What would you recommend?
Right. Well, first, of course, the Bible tells us to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. That's the city he's chosen. That's where Jesus died and rose again. That's where Jesus is coming back to. So we need to pray for peace there. And by that means geopolitical peace, but also means the spiritual revelation that Jews and Muslims and others in the region come to understand that Jesus himself is the Prince of Peace. And so we need to be praying first for Jerusalem, for Israel, but then we also need to pray for Israel's neighbors and her enemies, right? Jesus said, love your neighbors and love your enemies. And loving them means starting by praying for the Christians who are persecuted in that region, who are running for their lives, literally, from ISIS. You know, giving to ministries like the Joshua Fund that is providing winter coats, thousands of them, to people fleeing from this. We're providing audio Bibles. So people who don't know how to read or don't have time to read because they're refugees, they can just put an MP3 in that they get free from the ministries that we give them to and listen to the New Testament in Arabic, in Kurdish. We can be praying, we can be giving to ministries like the Joshua Fund, and we can be telling other people about what's happening using this book and, you know, using other resources to mobilize people. Christians need to be mobilized to make a difference. And prayer and evangelism and strengthening the local church is a critical element of that. And what we don't want to do is be silent, to do nothing, because we're going to stand before Jesus one day and we're going to be held to account. And we want to be found faithful in doing something to care for people who are suffering and caring for people who've never heard the good news that Christ loves them and died for them and is coming to get them.
Joel, is the best way to find out maybe more about your writings, your blogs, and maybe the Joshua Fund, can they just go to your website, joelrosenberg.com?
You can, yes, joelrosenberg.com. I've got a blog where I track the issues of the day. There you can find links to the Joshua Fund, links to the books, video and audio of interviews I've done on Huckabee and Hannity and Fox and others. It's sort of one-stop shopping, as it were. There's actually links to where you can buy the books and just some context and background on me or what we're doing if people aren't familiar.
Yeah. Joel, it's been great to visit with you. Blessings to you in this new year. And clearly this book is it's not finished. The last page, it's the first in a series.
Yes.
The last page reminds us of a dangling piece there at the very end. So, you know, but you don't want to wait till the next one comes out because it's a good read. The Third Target, the latest novel from Joel Rosenberg, best-selling author, and kind enough to give us a few minutes today. And wish you great opportunities for ministry and good writing here in 2015, Joel.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much, Neil. God bless you.
Joel Rosenberg with us, The Third Target. It's coming out from Tyndale, actually tomorrow, the release date. And, again, we've got a couple of copies we'll do a drawing for to give away. If you want to find out more, you can get a copy through Joel's website and find out about his regular writing and the Joshua Fund. It's Joel Rosenberg, B-E-R-G, joelrosenberg.com. Check that out. And if you missed part of today's program, you can always catch the podcast online at myfaithradio.com and then go to the Connecting Faith show page. Thanks for listening.